Jewish Audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad, South London, England.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to part 20 of our Jewish history course. This evening, after our stay in Tzfat last week, the blossoming of the Shulchan Aruch and of the Kabbalah, and then the equally quick demise of that community, we return this evening to Eastern Europe, specifically to Poland, which had become a safe haven for Jews. In fact, after the demise of Spanish Jewry, the center of Jewish history did shift, albeit for that brief moment in Israel, to Eastern Europe. The Jews in Poland lived in their ghettos and small villages, absorbed in the great heights of the Talmud and of Jewish mysticism. However, this evening I'm going to look at 5 points which strongly affected the history of that time. The first is what's popularly known as the Gezeiros of Tach Tat. A Gezeira, as you know, is a decree. Tach and Tat are the Hebrew letters Tav Ches and Tav Ches. Now, as you know, in the Hebrew calendar, we're now in the year 5760. When you write that, you in fact do not write the 5,000, that's taken as a given, you just write 760, and in numerals, in letters, which is in the Hebrew alphabet equivalent to numbers, Tav is equal to 400, Shin equal to 300, 400 and 300 and 700, Samach and 60, we are in the Hebrew year Tav, Shin, Samach. In the year Tach, Tav Ches, that was the year 5408. And Tat, Tav Tes, was the year 5409. Mention Tach Tat in most Jewish circles, and people reel in horror at a most dreaded calamity that befell the Jewish people in that particular time. Because, let me tell you what happened. In that year, corresponding to the English calendar year of 1648, when the Jews, after they'd been expelled in 1492 from Spain, had settled and had found in Poland a relatively peaceful time. In fact, Poland in Hebrew is called Polin, and it's made up of two Hebrew words, po, meaning here, lin, from the idea of lina, sleeping. Here we will be able to rest, or so they thought. The Jews lived quite isolated from the rest of the community, as we said before, and steeped in their own rituals. The typical Jew of Poland would wake up in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, he would recite the Tehillim, he'd immerse himself in the mikveh, in the river, and he would go to the shul, he'd daven with a minyan. After that, he would engage in some form of study, he'd then go to earn his livelihood, and which often was in and amongst the Gentiles, many of whom could speak Yiddish, because Yiddish was the spoken language. And then in the evening the Jew would go back to Daven Mincha and Ma'ariv in the shul. He would also go in another shir, and that's how they would spend their lives. A relatively pleasant life until the year 1648. But in this year, in a place called Preslov in the Ukraine, in Ukraine, the local populace were called Cossacks, and the Cossacks and the peasants in that town In fact, that area, Ukraine, at that time was controlled by Poland, and the local Cossacks rebelled against their Polish landlords. Now, the visible representative of the Polish landlord was the Jew. Why? Because the Jews were good tax collectors, they were good tavern keepers, they were good estate administrators, and they were good money lenders. Well, put those four trades together, and you've got four trades which the local populace hates. They would hate the tax collector because the heavy taxation from Poland would rob the Cossacks of their income. The tavern keepers would be very much in control of the liquor supply, which was in fact a very important part of their lives. The estate administrators would decide where they would or would not live, and money lenders would usurp them and extract interest from them. Those four things, in fact, pulled together, identified the Jew with the Polish landlords, therefore making them, the Jews, the focus of the local populace's hatred. And in 1648, there was a pogrom. They attacked and killed 2,000 Jews in a week, and the Cossacks made a rebellion against their Polish landlords, and it was in fact put down. The Poles sent an army and put down this Cossack rebellion. However, the Cossacks found a dynamic leader in the form of a man called Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Different people pronounce his last name different, Shmielniki or whatever, but in Yiddish he was called Khmelnytsky. That's how he's referred to. Khmelnytsky had a personal gripe against the Polish. They had abused him, they had taken his wife away from him, and he joined and led the Cossacks in their rebellion against the Poles. With great cunning and military acumen, it was Khmelnytsky who raised the banner of freedom, which in fact the entire Ukraine population decided to rally around him and join in order to throw the Poles out of their area. Another people called the Tatars also allied themselves with the Cossacks, and in the autumn of the year 1648 the Cossacks swept into Poland, town after town, in fact reaching the very heart of the Polish Empire, in fact the town of Lwów, which those who are familiar with Polish geography know that that is in fact very much in the center of Poland. And the Poles suffered an amazing defeat at the hands of the ruthless Cossacks, and they decided it would be better to make a truce with him rather than fight him to the end. So they granted him a noble title, they granted him autonomy for a Cossack state, as long as he paid some form of lip service to the Polish nobility. It must be said that it was not only the Jews suffered at the hands of the Cossacks. However, Polish nobility suffered if they came into a town and found a Polish landlord, poritz or whatever, then they would certainly punish him, his family, if not worse. Catholics, the Catholic Church suffered because the Cossacks were hell-bent against their, not so much against the religion, but against the corruption of the church, which had in fact supported the nobility in suppressing the masses. But it was the Jews who suffered the worst. Between 1648 and 1653, period of 5 years, 100,000 Jewish people were killed by the Cossacks in the Gezeiras, in those terrible decrees of Tachtat, 1648 and 1649. 300 communities decimated by the sweeping of the Cossacks right through Poland. Whoever didn't die by the hands of the Cossacks died by famine or disease. The cruelty of the Cossacks was unbelievable. A very, very inhumane nation, a very base people, whom we won't go into the gory details of their inhumanities, but perhaps we could say in history only perhaps equaled by the Nazis or by the Romans in the times of the Second Temple, destruction of the Second Temple. In fact, interesting historians compare those three atrocious times and the murderers to each other. Some even want to draw, in fact, a link between them. The Jews themselves preferred to fall into the hands of the Tatars rather than the Cossacks. The Tatars were much more of a conservative nature, and instead of killing them, they were willing to sell them instead on to Turks, to Turkish nobility, who in fact then resold them on to the Jewish communities of the Mediterranean coast. 30,000 Polish Jews managed to, quote unquote, escape through that method of selling, or in fact they were abducted by the Tatars selling them on. And so in fact we had an exile, or a re-exile of the Jews back from Poland, back into the Mediterranean. If you think about it, the Jews have now gone full circle all around Europe. They were exiled, let's say, from Babylon, coming over to Greece, Italy, and then finally moving on to Spain. 1492, they were expelled from Spain, and they'd had to move to France, Germany, Poland, and now they were going back again. And in fact, the Jewish communities of the Mediterranean coast did take them in with open arms and repatriate them. What is interesting to note in these massacres is the Jewish reaction. If we think about a period which I've just mentioned, the times when the Second Temple, when the Jews were fighting against the Romans, we find that the Jews were brilliant fighters. Take the story of Hanukkah, Yehuda Maccabee, the small number in the hands of many. We fought ferociously, and here we went sheepishly. What changed? The believers will say this is part of the curse of the Tochacha, of the biblical admonition to the Jewish people that in exile, where they will be sent because they didn't listen, they will be chased and none will be there to save them. Yet, we can perhaps say that at this stage in history, the Jew felt perhaps it was now an open-ended exile. Where else was there to go? He'd been in Spain and been kicked out. He'd been to the Mediterranean and been persecuted. Life was perhaps even not worth living under persecution. The Jew turned into a preference of having a low profile, a turned cheek. He adjusted to his status quo, no matter how degrading it was to accept. He didn't fight against it. The holiness of dying a death of martyrdom became a supreme act of sanctification, not surrender. The Jew never surrendered, nor did it enter his mind to convert. Unlike the Spanish experience, of where thousands of Jews did become conversos, maranos, and eventually routed out by the Inquisition. In this time, not that there was too much of a choice given, in certain cases was, in fact, initially the Cossacks did offer the Jews either conversion or martyrdom, but they saw that there were so few that accepted conversion, and even those apostates did it only openly, but secretly, again, they kept Judaism. So the Cossacks, in fact, rather smelled a rat quicker than they did at the time of the Inquisition, and they decided this is not for us, and just immediately got rid of them. And dying a death of martyrdom became an ultimate act of bravery and belief for the Jew. This truce that was drawn up between Chmielnytsky and the Poles didn't last for long. In the spring of 1649, the Cossack army turned north, and it in fact reached southern Lithuania. But its forces were scattered, and the Tatars at this stage defected to the Polish side, whichever side was more better, which was better for their own interests, as a war of politics. And in the August of 1649, another truce was signed. Whichever side the Jews were on, they always came out worse. On the 20th of Sivan, in the year 1649, there was a terrible massacre in the town of Nemirov. 6,000 Jews were killed on one day, in the 20th of Sivan, and it was reported that the river running through Nemirov turned red from blood. Now, let me just tell you an interesting historical fact over here. The Jews, even in this time, had organized themselves that they had in fact a council of different lands that became a governing body for Jews. How can I say? Perhaps we could compare it to the today. We could compare it to a European Council of Jews, a World Jewish Congress. A World Jewish Congress was a world thing. In England, I suppose you'd call it the Board of Deputies. But it was rather more not just localized in one country, but in a few different countries. The Jews of Poland, Lithuania, White Russia, and Volyn, which is northwest Ukraine, they got together in what was called the Council of the Four Lands. In Hebrew, they called it the Vad Arba Arotzes. The Vad, the Council of the Four Lands of Poland, Lithuania, Russia, and Volhynia. And they, in fact, instituted a public fast day on the 20th of Sivan for all generations. They said that from that day on, from that time on, to commemorate that terrible massacre in Nemirov, the 20th day of Sivan, and in fact in many communities today, people fast even today on that 20th of Sivan to commemorate this thing. In 1651, the revolution flared up again, but this time the Cossacks were beaten by the Poles. The Poles, this time, took up an aggressive stance towards the Jews, listen to this, claiming that it was of course the Jews who were the biggest collaborators with the Cossacks. In 1652, the Tatars rejoined the Cossacks, and there was more rebellion. To add insult to injury, in the summer of 1652, a plague of cholera swept through Poland, and thousands of Jews and non-Jews died in the town of Krakow, which then held records. It said that literally thousands of Jews were dying from cholera in that terrible summer. And it was then that thousands of Jews decided that no longer was life bearable in Poland, And they scattered east, many to Russia, Lithuania, the Balkans, and back to Germany. The rabbis looked very deeply into the reason for the gezeiras of Tachtat. Why did they happen? We could understand, said some, the Spanish expulsion. The Jews were assimilated. The Jews had risen to great heights. They had become great philosophers. And perhaps many had converted and not kept to their true faith. It could be for that reason they were expelled. But here, why did this happen? Some said, I mean, the Jews, on the whole, were as frum as you could be. The communities were traditional. Everybody had a simplistic sort of faith in Poland. Why did it happen? Some rabbis suggested that it was because we spoke in shul when we shouldn't have done. We spoke during the reading of the Torah. All sorts of ideas were formulated. Ultimately, nobody could put their finger on the scale of the devastation and its reason. But two things happened, interestingly, at this particular time, because of these terrible massacres, that really saved the Jews. And these were the two points that we mentioned in last week's shiur. You know, when you're being chased after, and the network of an infrastructure of your communities collapse, then there is no formal authority. The Jews needed something which would guide them, each one being here, one being over there, and of course the refuah, the healing measure, had been placed before the Makkah, before the plague, in the form of the Shulchan Aruch. Because we said last week that the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, had now been printed, universally accepted, Rabbi Yosef Karo's Code of Jewish Law, together with its notes and glossaries by Rabbi Moshe Isserlich, the Rama of Krakow, incorporating both Ashkenazic and Sephardic customs into one book, that had been printed, and wherever the Jew went, his Shulchan Aruch now went with him. One of the greatest rabbis of Poland at that time, in fact, was the chief rabbi of Krakow. His name was Rabbi Yehoshua Heschel of Krakow. He's often referred to as the Rebbe Reb Heschel. In fact, he was called a Rebbe long before, in fact, the Hasidic movement ever came on the scene. He was called the Rebbe Reb Heschel of Krakow. He had two very, very brilliant students. One was called Reb David Halevi Segal. Segal, by the way, is a Levi, a Sagan, they used to call it. The Sagan, Segal is another name, just like Katz. Katz is another name for a Kohen, because Kohen, Sedek, means a righteous Kohen, or a real Kohen. Take the first two letters of the word Kohen, Sedek, it's Kaf Tzadik, Katz. That's why thousands of Jews were called, thousands of Kohen were called Katz, Katz Nellenbogen, whatever. And Levim were called Segals. Now David Halevi Segal, he wrote a book called the Turei Zahav, which was a super commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, and another called Reb Shabsi Kohen, also a great student of the Rebbe Reb Heschel. He wrote a book called the Shach, the initials of his name, Shabsi Kohen, Shin Kof, Shach. And he also wrote a super commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. Both of them, by the way, had tragic life stories, which, because of the time limitations, we don't have enough time to tell the story, particularly of the Shach, an unbelievable life story of how he was, of how he wrote his book, and how he was hounded by the Cossacks, very nearly lost his life. In fact, Reb David Alevis lost sons. He lost children to the Cossacks. They both lived a very terrible, very traumatic lives, and yet specifically in those years produced commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, which catapulted the Shulchan Aruch into being the post-Talmudic code. It was now irrevocably installed as being the most important code because these people had written such great commentaries on this. In fact, it's interesting, the Taz was much older than the Shach, and yet both of their works were printed, and each one saw the other's works. And in fact, seeing they were both writing on the same thing, in a number of issues they disagreed. So what they did subsequently was to both print a critique of the other one's work, okay, and then defend a subsequent work which defended their original work against the critique of the other one. So it's fascinating, and by the way, all this is printed in the large version of the Code of Jewish Law which we have, and it's fascinating to learn. You can learn what Rabbi Yosef Karo said, what Rabbi Moshe Isserlich said, then you have a look at what the Taz, the Turizav, Rav David Alevis Segal will say, and the Shach might disagree in his critique. He'll defend himself, and then he'll attack him for another area. And through all this discussion, which was surrounding the Shulchan Aruch became, as it still remains today, the focal point of Jewish law. That's one thing that happened as a result of the Chelmanitsky massacres. But perhaps more important than that, or equally important, was the increased spread of the learning of Kabbalah, of mysticism, throughout Polish Jewry. We had already mentioned that in this brief spell in Israel, it was Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, the Arizal of blessed memory, whom had taught Lurianic Kabbalah, and now that was taken up like a sponge by Polish Jewry. And the reason was very simple. How can you bear such pain? How can you bear such horror? You can't live through such terrible times purely with a rational, philosophical, analytical, scholarly approach. No. You must rather live in a world of souls and spirits. Pain, death, destitution could only affect the body, but they couldn't affect the soul. This inner Kabbalistic world held out hope, comfort, and purpose. And so we see, ladies and gentlemen, that through great devastation, through great trauma, the Jew drew within. Now this is a fascinating response, because at the end of this evening's talk, we end up this evening with enlightenment. And what I would like to do, perhaps not this evening, but perhaps next week, is to look at the responses to the exile that the Jewish people have put forward in their various forms. How do we cope with all this? Do we assimilate? That hasn't proved good either. Do we live in our ghettos? Do we cut ourselves away from the rest of the world? That we can't do either. Is it a bit of both? The truth is, no one path has not been tried by any person. It's all paths have been tried. Some with terrible consequences, others with measures of success. But in this period, the Jews yet never considered assimilation as an alternative. And it's fascinating, until we'll soon discuss, until the beginners of reform came along, the Jews, until this period, if you think about it, never considered in the Spanish area. It was only out of coercion that the Jews converted. They would have rather have lived in their own communities. In the Khmelnytsky times, Jews didn't consider conversion as an alternative. Khmelnytsky himself, by the way, died in August 1657. Within a few years, his Cossack autonomous area had been taken over by Russia. That 15-year revolution, starting in 1648, didn't achieve its goal for Cossack autonomy. What it did achieve was hundreds of thousands of people being murdered. Today, what's left of Bogdan Khmelnytsky is a statue in the city of Kiev, where they hold him as one of their great saints of a past era. And by the late 1650s, Jewish life had returned to some form of normality. One can compare this to the 1933 to 1945 period, a huge upheaval changing the face of the Jewish world, moving people on both in geography, in history, in philosophy, in spirit, in mood, in movement. Two great upheavals which devastated the Jewish people. And yet, we now embark, things hadn't finished yet. Things hadn't finished yet because from within there was another attack. That was an attack from without. At the very same time, the Jewish people encountered an attack from within. And this was a false messianic hope led by a man called Shabbatai Tzvi. Now, Shabbatai Tzvi was born in a town called Smyrna in Turkey. He in fact was ordained as a chacham, as a rabbi, at an early age. And he steeped himself in mysticism, in Kabbalah. He practiced ascetic ways, he flagellated himself. At the age of 22, he'd been married twice noch, both marriages ending in divorce. Some historians say that the history of that time indicates that he was somewhat of a manic depressive, but charismatic he certainly was. In 1648, just at the time of the Khmelnytsky massacres, he started having messianic delusions. So in fact you had two things composite. You had a tremendous massacre going on in Poland, and in Turkey, which of course is the area where the Jews are fleeing to, for this, literally by the skin of their teeth, you have this man saying that the Mashiach is coming, or that he is the Mashiach. How did that happen? As soon as he started having these messianic delusions, the people of his hometown thought he was crackers, and they excommunicated him. He travelled around for a number of years. He arrived in Constantinople in 1658, which was after already the Crusaders of Tahtat had subsided. But they also wanted to excommunicate him. In 1662, he made his way to Israel, and in 1663 arrived in Yerushalayim. Now, as has been the case many cases in history, often a charismatic leader is propelled to the limelight by another character who believes in him fervently. And this happened in the case of Shabbatai Tzvi. There was a young man called Nathan of Gaza, who attached himself soul, heart and soul to Shabbatai Tzvi, and he convinced himself and Shabbatai Tzvi that he was the Mashiach. In the summer of 1665, on the festival of Shavuos, Nathan of Gaza pronounced Shabbatai Tzvi was the Mashiach. And Shabbatai Tzvi, although there was sort of not exactly a refusal, but a humble response, he didn't exactly say no either. And the masses started idolizing him. The truth is, Shabbatai Tzvi was inconsistent in his observance even. He did indulge in some forms of licentious behavior. Nathan explained this away as a messianic right, if you want. Shabbatai Tzvi's fame spread. The Jews of Greece, Italy, Syria, and Egypt felt that due to what was going on, the cataclysmic upheavals of Europe, and now the fact that even Kabbalistically the year 1648 was supposed to be a end time for the Mashiach's coming, and the fact that somebody has proclaimed himself as Mashiach, they in fact were ready and sold their possessions ready to move to the land of Israel to be with Shabbatai Tzvi. They even made changes in the liturgy in order to express that the Messianic era was upon them. This fever, Mashiach fever, in 1665 reached Poland and Russia itself. There was a huge amount of apocalyptic propaganda which was spread out. Shabbatai Tzvi himself by that time moved back to Turkey, and he had sort of installed himself as a form of an emperor, and he held court in Smyrna and in Constantinople. Tributes kept pouring into him from all over the Jewish world. People needed this. It's an English word for not an opium to the masses, but a type of medication that everybody needs. I'm trying to look for the correct word for it. It was just an elixir which everybody needed. There was such a depression in the Jewish world, and now somebody had come along. However, in the summer of 1666, Shabbatai Tzvi took the bold step of abolishing national Jewish fast days. He abolished the 17th of Tammuz, the day when the walls of the temple had been breached, and he abolished Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. And that was fine with everybody, because now Mashiach was coming, and therefore what did you need to keep Tisha B'Av for? However, it's supposed to be a festival. However, he himself started eating treif. And not only that, he indulged in some immoral behavior. And he said the following. You know, there's a bracha that we say every single morning in shul. We say, Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Matir Asurim, which means who releases those who are bound up. That means when you wake in the morning, some say this bracha with more concentration and kavanah than others. Those who find it difficult to in fact stretch and to sort of stretch all your bones when you get up in the morning, the very fact that you can get out of bed and stand up is itself a reason to thank Hashem every single morning. So you say, thank you Hashem for releasing me. And also you say another bracha for standing me up. Now the correct Hebrew is Matir Asurim, who releases the one who is bound up. Shabbatai Tzvi said that now we should change the blessing to Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Matir Isurim. That thank God who allows or who releases ones from prohibitions. Isurim are prohibitions. And he said that now the Torah has changed and you can now start doing a whole host of things which is against Halacha, because it says that when Mashiach will come, Mashiach will reinstitute Torah law in its entirety. And here already people smelled a rat. A lot of people became very alarmed at his behavior. The Sultan of Turkey himself was very alarmed at his behavior and had him under house arrest. Shabbatai Tzvi continued to hold court. However, in September 1666, the Sultan of Turkey presented him with a choice. We're fed up. We've had enough of you. You're a bit of an imposter. Do you have messianic claims or not? He said no. He said, right, well, if you don't, you can have a choice. Martyrdom or conversion? He said, conversion, please. And he became a convert to Islam. He took an Islamic name, he became an apostate, and everybody's delusions were broken. Everybody's hopes were dashed. It was as if everybody had been geared up. This had been what we'd been waiting for after Khmelnytsky. That somebody would lead us back to the promised land. A savior, a Moses. Shabbatai Tzvi was supposed to be the one. And it ended in gloom and doom. This exposure, by the way, of Shabbatai Tzvi caused a huge anti-reaction in the Jewish world. A reaction, interestingly enough, against Kabbalah. Because Shabbatai Tzvi had been the one that had based his messianic delusions on mystical Jewish ideas, and therefore anybody from then on who was found to be non-conforming with acceptable traditional Jewish behavior was scrutinized severely by all rabbinic authorities. In fact, one can possibly say that this was the fuel behind the Vilna Gaon's objection to the Hasidic movement. He felt perhaps that they too were steeped too much in mysticism, and that's why he excommunicated them. Although that didn't help, but because I'm still here to tell the story. we'll have to study the Vilna Gaon and his time at a different time. However, let's keep ourselves to Shabbatai Tzvi. In the Jewish communities, anybody who came up now and started espousing a philosophy which was variant, he was immediately shut down. One of these people, whom I'm sure you'll have all heard of, was a young man called Baruch Spinoza in the community of Amsterdam. He woke up one day and formulated his own philosophical system of life, a system of pantheism where he identifies God with the natural forces in creation, and he was excommunicated by the Amsterdam Jewish community. He went on, in fact, to become one of the great thinkers of his time. His books are still read today. However, as all these people, the variants sank into oblivion. Another interesting example was a tremendous dispute which rose between two European rabbis. One was called Rabbi Yaakov of Emden. He, in fact, was the son of a rabbi called the Chacham Tzvi. He was called Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi. He was the rabbi of the Ashkenaz community of Amsterdam. His son, Rabbi Yaakov of Emden, from the town of Emden, he had a major dispute with another rabbi called Rabbi Yonason Eibschutz, who was the rabbi of Ahu. Now, Ahu is not a town, it's three towns all in one. Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek in Germany. there was a rabbi that sort of was the rabbi. That was, by the way, one of the most prestigious positions. It was like the flagship of the of German communities. If you got that, if you were a rabbi at that time, well, it's tremendous. And Rabbi Jacob Emden accused Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz of being a follower of Shabbatai Tzvi. How did that come about? Because Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz himself was a Kabbalist and distributed kameyas. Now, a kameya is an amulet. And inside one of these amulets, which was distributed by Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, was found to be some veiled references to Shabbatai Tzvi. That was enough for Rabbi Yaakov Emden to do his knot, to publicly wish to excommunicate Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz. By the way, I want to tell you that both these two rabbis wrote amazing works, both of which are studied today. Rabbi Yaakov Emden wrote a Siddur, he wrote a commentary on the Siddur of the Yavetz. He also wrote extensively on Jewish law, on Halacha. Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz also, he was a genius as a young child. The fact there's a whole book of stories about Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz as a child. Even as a child, he was a child prodigy. And his books were also well accepted in the Jewish world. And yet, I could only say that, for example, when the controversy between Louis Jacobs and Jonathan Sachs, you know, was at its height, when they in correspondence in the Jewish Chronicle, that was child's play compared to this. Here you had whole communities involved and Rabbanim, and it was, and excommunications were flying around. The Jewish community was on wheels. Now this is an incredible thing. We've managed to be able to do this. We've managed to be able, at the same time as being pogromed and massacres and dealing with all these external influences, inside we've also managed to be tremendously bombastic, have polemics, excommunications, to be fractious and have different groupings, tremendous debates, all throwing up great leaders, people to inspire us and so on and so forth. And these two are going on in tandem right throughout history. It's an amazing thing. In fact, they had to bury him in a grave just before Shabbos. And a grave had not been dug. So they buried him, not where he wanted to be buried, but in a grave that had been dug for somebody else. And that grave turned out to be only a few graves away from Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, his great opponent. So although in life they were separated by ideals, in death they were immortalized by, in fact, being buried almost together. There were other false messiahs at that time. Jacob Frank was one of them. Again, his rise and fall ended only in debacle, but it was really nothing compared to the Shabbatai Tzvi fiasco. So you've had the Chelmanitsky massacres, the Gzeiras of Tachtach. That created a situation where Jews focused on the Shulchan Aruch as their light and guide. Kabbalah and mysticism was widespread because it kept them sane. Shabbatai Tzvi came along and placed anybody who learned Kabbalah under great scrutiny. There was a tremendous move to traditionalism, and then came along in the Jewish world the, I'm going to call it perhaps one of the most destructive forces that ever arose. Others of course will argue and say, how could you say such a thing, but that's my opinion. Since I'm giving the share, I feel entitled to say that, and that is enlightenment. Until this time, yes, there had been variant sects in Judaism. But perhaps the most variant sect we could go back to would be, for example, the Hellenists in the Second Temple period. The Jews had become more Greek than Jewish. But after the expulsion, after the destruction of the Second Temple, when the Jews had been gone to Babylon and then to Spain and so on and so forth, they had always been absorbed in the fabric of the society which they'd been, but they were distinctly Jewish. Either made so by the local populace, by wearing a badge or other forms of identity, or by persecution. And it had never occurred in all that time for them to if you want, assimilate. Either they converted, became apostates, or they remained Jewish. But there was never this middle ground of becoming enlightened. And it was specifically at this time in history, unparalleled, that a wave of enlightenment came through the Jewish community. And that was started, and perhaps a man who is called the father of the Reform movement was started by a man called Moses Mendelssohn. In fact, his father's name was Menachem Mendel, which is a Chassidish name. He was called Moses ben Menachem Mendel, known therefore as Mendelssohn. He was born in Dessau, Germany, in 1729, and in fact he received a traditional Jewish education. He was well versed in Talmud and the Bible. Aged 14, his parents sent him to Berlin to get a good secular education. He was outwardly observant. In fact, he translated the Bible into German. What a feat! He wrote great philosophical works, some of which initially attained the approbation of some of the great rabbis of the time. And yet, as I said beforehand, is today viewed as the father of Reform Jewry. In fact, some of his children and grandchildren became Christians. And perhaps that, more than anything, is a statement of how his false ideals and ideas and philosophies reflected themselves so clearly in his own family. Mendelssohn became known for his one-liner, "Be a cosmopolitan man in the street and a Jew at home." He was personally convinced that he could remain observant, an observant Jew at the emperor's court, in intellectual circles. He could hold his own. When he was debating philosophy, when he was talking to the intelligentsia of Germany, he could hold his own, he could show that he was just as intelligent and in fact have a great effect on them. And privately, remain an observant Jew. What he did not realize is that although he may have been able to do it, although not successfully, just look at his family, others could not hold that path. He opened the gate to a flood of enlightenment. He was personally hurt, by the way, by stunning criticisms of the contemporary rabbinate against his approach to modernity and Judaism. They felt this was not the way forward. You could not and you cannot expect a Jew to live in the secular world and act, if you want, as a non-Jew, as a goy, in all your ways, and just be Jewish at home. The opportunity, however, which Mendelssohn saw in equality and civil rights, intellectual and economic advancement, blinded him to the risks of enlightenment. But let me say this in his favour, or perhaps I shouldn't. Do we blame him? After all the Jews had suffered, when you have this burning desire for equality, you want civil rights at the end of the day. You want to be accepted by the people, the indigenous population. You want to get on with people. You want to live a normal standard of life. Is that too much to ask? Do you have to live chosen to die? Is it too much? And yet, Ezehu Chacham, who is a wise man, says the ethics of the fathers, Haroya es hanoynad, he who sees the results of his actions. Mendelssohn did not envisage the results of his actions. The truth is, his own premises about Judaism were very much tainted by his own philosophy, by the philosophy of enlightenment. He did personally believe in revelation. He believed that there was a revelation at Sinai. He did believe that ritual law was law for the Jew. However, his principle was that God revealed himself at Sinai. He gave the Jews rituals, and all this ritual and revelation was to lead to the understanding of the morality of the Torah, which is universal in its essence. Now, logically, if you take that to its natural conclusion, the logic conclusion is that once the entire world embraces the morality of the Torah, well, the ritual has achieved its aim, and therefore you no longer need it, and therefore you can discard it, and therefore you can reform it. Judaism, in his mind, should join society implementing the moral truths of the Torah. You see which way around is coming. That we need to join society implementing what the Torah says is right. It's interesting. His translation of the Bible into German, the point of it became no longer to let German Jews who couldn't read Hebrew understand the Bible. No. The point of his translation was so that Talmid HaChachamim, those Jews who had been steeped in the learning of Talmud, and those Jews who had been steeped in the learning of Mishnah, and couldn't read German, would be able to be enlightened now by his translation of the Bible into German. It was through the Bible that they could learn German, and not through the knowledge of German to learn the Bible. Other philosophers came along in his wake. One of the famous or infamous ones, a man called Immanuel Kant. Kant insisted on moral autonomy. Man being the sole arbiter of human, universal moral ideas. He put forward the philosophy, of course, which we don't believe in, that the Torah was only binding to the extent that man was willing to accept its individual teachings. Of course, this is the philosophy of reform. It's interesting. I'll just say something about reform today. I have found in my limited travels in the Jewish world that you find two types of reformed Jews, or let me say, three types of reformed Jews. There is no doubt about it, a hard core today of reformed Jews, intellectuals who have embraced this philosophy. However, I would say they are in a minority. The majority of reformed Jews have joined reform for one of two reasons. The first reason is that because of status, they can no longer belong to an Orthodox institution. Intermarriage, marriage of forbidden relationships, Cohen to a divorcee, mamzer, etc., etc., conversion process being too long in the Orthodoxy, that's why they'll belong to Reform. Religion of perhaps convenience. The other reason is because they do not understand the Orthodox service, they do not understand Hebrew, the language and mode of service is foreign to them. Reform is more accessible. Now, by the way, of those two reasons, you can deal with the second one, you can't deal with the first. You can make Orthodoxy more palatable, you can make it more accessible, you can make it user-friendly, but you can't change status. And I would say, in my travels in the Reform world, you get stuck at a certain stage by issue number one, and you can't move forward sometimes. It's a very sticky situation. Having said that, I once had it out with a Reform minister. He told me he was studying tractate Bava Basri, who's above Matthias, who's even a Gemara Shia. I said to him, how can you give a Gemara Shia and tractate Bava Matthias when tractate Shabbos, which talks about the 39 categories of work, you reject? And the answer was that this is Jewish history, this is Jewish mental gymnastics, and it is open for individual scrutiny. It's interesting, in short. That's not the approach. It's not the Orthodox approach, as of course you'll understand. But this is the approach which Mendelssohn taught on. He wrote a commentary on the entire Torah. He was a very clever man. He called it the Biur. And he said that this is a necessary first step to culture. Please, German Jewry, read my book. You'll become more cultured. He was convinced that Judaism could only survive in an enlightened, cultured world only if you became part of that culture. In one sentence, Jacob was to be defined by Esau's standards. When he died in 1786, the old Europe was fast disappearing, the ghetto walls were crumbling, the Jews were entering a much more dangerous world than Mendelssohn had envisaged. He thought that the way to deal with the issues was enlightenment. In fact, it proved that that was no more effective than, in fact, inward-bound traditional Jewish orthodoxy, or even going more mystical, Jewish mysticism. Because Hitler, Yimach Shemah, he put a stop to everything. That was, if you want, the full stop at the end of the Jewish historical sentence, as far as we're concerned, as far as theories and theories about how best, if you want to get on with your non-Jewish, how best to get on with your non-Jewish neighbours. Well, the German Jewry, following on from his example, assimilated to the nth extent, more than anybody had ever assimilated previously in history, and they were uprooted to the man. So that didn't work. Also, responses to the exile are fascinating. We will, in Yitzhak Hashem, next week, go on to look at other responses. We need to follow this debate between the enlightened reformers and between the traditionals. I'd like to look at next week although we're jumping now in history, we're not exactly going in a linear historical track, but I'd like to look at, in Germany, for example, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, being the valiant fighter against the Enlightenment. And then I'd like to move over to Russia to talk about the rising of the Hasidic movement and its opponents, both of whom provided alternative and viable alternatives against Enlightenment, both of whom and all of whom suffered ultimately at the hands of the Enlightenment, right to this present day. And it really is all a debate about how the Jews are to survive. And what is so fascinating about the contemporary debate is we all thought this debate would subside upon the creation of the State of Israel. Do you know, it really is that the word I was looking for was the panacea. We all thought that the panacea, that the solution to all this, which Theodore, bless him, was right to a certain extent, it would be to create a land for ourselves. Not in Uganda, that he was wrong, but in Israel, yes. And yet today, 50 years on, has it solved all of our problems? No. Looking at hindsight, looking with hindsight, it's fascinating to look at the contemporary problem from a historical perspective. Let us look through history and look and try and see which reaction to exile was successful or ended in debacle, and transfer that to Israel. Which reaction, not to exile but to the Jewish condition, was successful? One thing is for sure, and I'll repeat something I said when we were studying about the Second Temple period. Then, in the Second Commonwealth, then there was that schism between the Pharisees and the Hellenists, between the traditionals and the Greek-cultured Hellenist Jews. That ended in, unfortunately, in exile, due to sinas chinam, due to hatred for no reason. We must find a way. And I think actually that history is a very, very good way to look into this problem of looking at our past mistakes, relating to each other, and finding a path forward by reflecting on our with a historical perspective, as we've done this evening, as to which alternative has allowed Jews to flourish. We're not talking here about survival. Survival, we've survived. Do you know, if anything today a Jew can be sure of, is that we'll survive. If we've survived till here, we'll survive. Anybody who thought that the Jews would be wiped out, I'm afraid the last 3,000 years of history has taken care of that problem. If you can live through everything we've lived through, we can live further. And do you know, that's a miracle. That was said in the Bible and you've got to believe in it. The question is not how can we physically survive. The question is, how can we survive together? How can we spiritually survive? Is it through assimilation? Is it through all enlightenment? Is it through a return to our ways of old? And the truth is, that golden chain has never been broken. And I would argue and rest the case with you this evening that right throughout, with all the upheavals in Jewish history, one thing has definitely remained a constant, and that is traditional, good old fashioned Yiddishkeit, getting up in the morning, putting your tefillin on, keeping your Shabbos, having a mezuzah on your door. That has been a constant. And I often think that, I often look at it, I don't know why, but I often look at it as, imagine something going down a railway track. And you have little runners going across the railway track. The train is moving. You have sometimes going forward and back and round. The train is moving. the Jewish people have a certain destiny. Some people will stray, will come back, stray off again to the different direction, and come back, and so on and so forth. Many people haven't come back. I often think of all these conversions, Maranos, Conversos, apostates, and so on and so forth. Where did all these people go? They're lost, quote unquote. They are lost, so to speak. They don't even know that they're Jewish. But a tremendous amount of Jewish blood must be flowing and is flowing all around Europe that really doesn't know that it is Jewish. And this is going to be one of the great aspects of Mashiach's coming, when Mashiach will eventually arrive, that then Jews will be able to see, and this is what traditional Judaism believes in, a return to Torah Judaism as it always has been, and see that in a very clear perspective, that that has been the factor that has in fact carried the Jews right throughout the centuries. And it's this that we want to imprint on our youth today. It's this, through outreach programs and through historical overviews like this, to imprint on our youth today that do what you want. There is nothing new under the sun. Jews have tried it. It has failed. What has not failed has been ultimately what Hashem said at Sinai. And if you, as it says, the song goes, if I will keep the Sabbath, then God will keep me. Thank you.